This podcast is produced by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. KPP Financial. Independent thinking, shared success. And now today's podcast.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Welcome to Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. We try to bring you useful information and answer any questions you might have, as long as they're financial. Now, we get together every day, every weekday at least, to sort out the issues that maybe impact your retirement, your savings, your investments. It's what we do every day, answer questions about that and talk about things or events that will cause us pain or pleasure. Our topics are wide ranging, and you guys can call about anything financial. How to start a 529 program. What is a 529 program? Short selling. What is short selling? Taxes, auto purchases, insurance purchases, real estate purchases. So we're open to any money matter that's on your mind. It's about strategies. Knowing the ins and outs of both these types of savings vehicles can help you make the right choice for your retirement. When to switch from a Roth IRA to a traditional 401k or a traditional IRA. That's our main talking point today. First, let's go to the phones, as we always try to do, try to get to them fast as we can and answering your questions. The number is 888-99-CHART.
Hey, this is Will from Atlanta. I had some friends asking about like investing in me, kind of, like, or me investing for them in a way. But they're also like pretty interested in investing and like learning about it. So I was wondering what the options are as far as do you make an investment club or an investment fund and how exactly that works. You know, I'd read about some under 100 member rules and under certain amount of money rules, but I was wondering if you had any input on that. Appreciate your time. Thanks.
Okay, let's talk about, you can be an investment advisor. You can be an advisor for somebody without any license. You don't have to become a registered investment advisor. You don't have to register. You don't have to do anything. But you can manage. You can only manage under $25 million or less. So you can be somebody else's money manager if you want to. You can also start an investment club in which you and a bunch of other people put money in every month. And then you set it up as a club and you decide what you're going to buy. What you're going to buy, when you're going to, what you're going to sell, and they can meet like once a month or however, whatever schedule you want to set up to set up a club. And there's you can find how to do it on the internet. It's not hard. It's fairly simple, actually. So there's a lot of ways you can do that and get together with friends, or if you want to start your own little business, you can do it. It's fairly simple. As soon as you get above $25 million in managing money under management, though, then you have to become a registered investment advisor, which is not, you know, an impossible task. Good question. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Love to hear from you. Give me a call. Let's go to talk to Sean in San Jose. How you doing, Sean?
My wife and I are business owners of a small business located in the Bay Area here. And we're looking to get her set up with an initial retirement account of some sort. We need to get some advice on taking that route. You know, if we're able to do it through a local bank or a suggested institution, I'd like to get some feedback from you on that.
You probably do a SEP IRA. SEP, have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
And you can also do now what's called an individual 401k. But that's harder, a little bit harder to set up, an individual 401k, you know, but I would probably suggest a SEP. Is it just you and your wife, or is there employees?
Correct. It's just myself, my wife, and the rest of the folks that work there are contract workers.
Okay. So then a SEP would probably be the first step. You could put like $15,000, $16,000 away, you know. And if you want to do more than that, then you're going to have to get a little bit more sophisticated. And it would be my suggestion, if you're going to do a SEP IRA, it's just like open up a regular IRA. You just go to like a Schwab or E-Trade or whatever you're comfortable with, and okay. just open it up almost anywhere, Fidelity, Vanguard, anywhere you want. And you say, I want to set up a SEP IRA.
Okay, now you said $15,000 to $16,000. Is that an annual contribution?
Yes.
Or is that over the... Okay, got it.
Yes.
And what would I typically look to, or a minimum that I would have to be able to contribute, and what would that frequency be?
There is no minimum, just a maximum. You could put $1,000 in this year. That's all, because you didn't make any money. You could put in zero next year because you didn't make any money. Third year, you made a ton of money. You could put $15,000 in that year.
Great. Okay. And can you tell us on how aggressive, I'm not sure if you can do the calculation, she's approximately 30 years of age right now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how aggressive should we be getting to putting this thing away, you know, with rough calculations?
You should be as aggressive as you can in the early years, but usually it's a conundrum because in the early years you're not making a lot of money. You know, but
right.
really the more advantage to you is to put as much as you can early on, and therefore it has more years to grow. That's the smartest thing to do, but sometimes it's impossible to do because you don't make a lot of money, you know. But, you know, you should be as aggressive as you can without having a miserable life. How's that? You know?
Certainly. Fair enough. Going to the default contribution, should we probably just spread it across between low risk, medium risk, and high risk?
No, you probably should be in mostly high risk because you're so young. And again, that's a personality thing. If you guys are very, very, very conservative and kind of worrywarts, if you're that kind of, that's your nature, and I'm not saying that as a negative thing, I'm just stating a fact. If you're the type of person that worries, then you probably won't want to be as aggressive. But at age 30 or in your 30s, you really should be aggressive because you got lots and lots of years.
Great. Thanks for the insight. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Sean. Thank you very much. 888-99-CHARTER is our number, 888-992-4278. Patrick, Mill Valley, how you doing?
Here's my question. What I want to know is, my wife and I are so busy with our kids and stuff, and I'm really responsible for the portfolio of my retirement, which I watch pretty closely, but a lot of times we just have a tough time taking care of the bills.
Right.
And I didn't know if there's how you might go about getting like someone to help you with that.
Paying the bills or help managing your portfolio?
The bills, because the portfolio I can stay on top of, but taking care of the bills, everything just goes crazy, and I'm trying to, you know, make sure I put enough in the retirement, but then there's always these bills popping up with kids and, you know, just life.
That is a real pain in the butt. That is life, though, isn't it, Patrick?
Yeah.
If you're talking about actually physically paying the bills, these days, almost all the bill payers, all of them, allow you to pay it online and be automatic about it. In other words, you never have to issue a check.
Oh, I see.
And almost all of them will let you set up a mortgage, electric bill, all those normal bills you get every month.
Right.
Every one of them would much prefer you not send them a check. Much prefer you do it automatically through your checking account, just do a transfer, and let them notify you've collected your money and here's what the bill was.
Okay.
And that would save you a lot of headache. All the young guys in my office, that's how they do it. They never issue checks. Now,
okay.
I must admit, my wife is a dinosaur. She pays the bills at the house.
Yeah, that's my wife, too.
Yeah, and she writes checks out, and I've tried to convince her to do otherwise. At the office, I have automatic pays a lot.
Okay.
Boy, does it save a lot of time and headache.
Yeah. Okay, I'll look into that.
That will help you. That'll help you a lot.
Okay.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks.
Appreciate the call. 888-99-CHART. Love to hear from you. Give me a call. This is Invest Talk.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278. Let's go to Julia and Julian.
Hi, I have a question. I'm about 55 years old, and I'm a novice and don't really know where to start.
Okay.
I would like to get into the market probably with a mix of stocks and bonds and cash.
Okay.
I'm wondering what percentage you would recommend of each one.
There is a rule of thumb. It depends on you and how aggressive and how much money you want to invest. You know, if you're just starting out, I would be very timid about getting in the market right now.
Okay.
Your experience level is very low, so you want to be very careful. There's a rule of thumb that your age dictates how much bonds you should have. So if you're 55, 55% of your money should be in bonds. I'm not buying that rule of thumb because there are times when being in bonds is just terrible and times when they're better to be in bonds. The time not to be in bonds is when interest rates are low because interest rates will probably rise. You're not getting very good yield. So it'd be better to go and do dogs of the Dow, high dividend paying, very big companies would get you more money, generally speaking. And don't buy too much of any one company. There's some rules. We never, for instance, I never buy more than 3 to 5% of a company, my overall portfolio. So that means you have a number of stocks. You can also invest using ETFs. You know what those are? Exchange-traded funds. They're like mini mutual funds, and you can buy sectors. Let's say you think the medical sector is a good place. Well, there's a number of ETFs that you could just, you give you instant diversification by ETF. You might want to start with the ETFs.
Now, as far as the taxes on ETFs, are you taxed on the gains like you would be in a mutual fund?
Yes. When you sell it, though. And unlike the mutual funds where you get capital gains distributed to you, even though
right.
you made, that doesn't happen in ETFs.
Oh, okay.
Only when you sell it, like a stock. You make gains or you have losses, that's when you have to pay the taxes.
Okay.
Thanks, Julie. Appreciate the call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Hope it works for you. Okay. When do you switch from your Roth to your 401k? Now, when I say when do you switch, putting money into the Roth into putting it to a 401k? Now, that question should immediately bring into your mind taxes. In a Roth, you're putting money into that after-tax money. In other words, you're already taxed on the money. In a 401k, you don't have to pay any taxes on it. So the question is, do I contribute in my 401k or my IRA, my regular IRA, so I can deduct that from my adjusted gross income so that I won't have to pay taxes on that money? Versus a Roth, where I put money in the Roth after tax dollars, but the good thing about that is I never have to pay taxes on the growth of that Roth. In a 401k, in a regular IRA, when you start taking out in retirement, that is added to your income, and you've got to pay taxes on all of it in there, the original investment plus all the growth. So it's really a tax question. When is it the best time? Should I try to reduce my taxes? And I tell people, Roths, to me, feel like a better investment when you're younger. And you have a lot of time to grow because all that growth you never have to pay taxes on again, ever. So I do like Roth. I do like Roth, but I also like regular IRAs and regular 401ks too, because in retirement you can withdraw from these retirement accounts any way you want to, and you can always know that when you withdraw from your regular IRA or 401k, that's tax dollars. Which will be taxed and the Roth won't be, so that you can withdraw from both, trying to keep yourself in the lowest tax bracket for the year. And that's really the key. It's all about taxes. And therefore, you're going to have to maybe get some accounting help, some from an accountant. But, you know, there's times when you want to reduce your tax bite as much as possible. When you're in a high tax bracket, you need to put money aside as much as you can. When you're in a low tax bracket, it probably is, you know, better to put in a Roth. But you don't. I can't say this is the rule of thumb and do it this way, because it also depends on you and your financial situation. This is Invest Talk, everybody. I'm Steve Peasley. Questions? Maybe you change jobs. Want to know more about rolling over your 401k into an IRA? We can talk about that. Reach me now on Invest Talk. Bobby and Goal are next. Then maybe you. 888-99-CHART.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
888-99-CHART, we'll go to Will in the Bay Area. Hi, Will, how you doing?
Hey, okay. I just wanted to get some insight, more insight, I guess. I kind of think I know what happens, but when the market goes down,
yes.
What is that mechanism? How does it really work?
Yeah.
Where is the money going? Say, for instance, I know where it goes for those who get out. They have it.
Uh-huh.
But they also lose a penny or two. But say, for instance, someone stays in, what happens to their money? Is that just a discounted thing, or how does it work?
Okay. Let's say you own a stock. That's what we're talking about, right, Will?
Mm-hmm.
And the stock is at $30 a share. And the stock goes down in price. It goes down to $20 a share. Where did that $10 go? Is that what your question is?
Yeah, and what causes it?
It's very simple. Let's say I own a share of stock and you want to buy it. Mm-hmm. I paid $20 a share for this stock and you said, I want to buy it, but I'm only going to give you $19 a share. And mm-hmm. I'm going to say, no, I'm not going to sell it to you for that. I want 20 or 21. You say, mm-hmm. no. You're going to pay me 19. And I then get nervous and get desperate, and I sell it to you for $19 a share.
Mm-hmm.
That $1 disappeared. It vanishes. Mm-hmm. It's gone.
Right.
It doesn't go into anybody's pocket. It's just gone.
That's what I thought. Yeah, it just disappeared.
It's gone. So if the whole right. market goes down 20%,
mm-hmm.
that money just vanishes.
Right, and it's based on, that's what I thought, it's based on that dollar per dollar discount, either by leaving or bidding.
That's right.
Yeah.
The market is just nothing but an auction area.
Mm-hmm.
This person
mm-hmm.
says, I'll bid this. This person says, I want that. And mm-hmm. they come to an agreement or they don't. And the stocks mm-hmm. go up and down based on that. That's simple as that.
So, yeah, and if I had all the money and you just kept saying, well, I don't care.
Exactly.
Eventually, I got to give you some.
Exactly. So eventually, you'll say, you know what? Let's say I have that $20 stock. And the stock gives you 10% income in dividends a year. The stock keeps growing its earnings forever. Mm-hmm. That stock has a value, but what that value is between you and I.
Mm-hmm.
You right. and I are deciding that. And you
yeah.
may decide, I'm not going to pay more than $10.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't find anybody else and I need to sell it, that stock's mm-hmm. going to go down to $10 to sell it to you.
Right. Now, what if you just refuse to budge? If
then,
you're a holder,
then that means you have a locked market and nothing gets sold and nothing gets bought.
Right, yeah, and your stock will just sit there.
Just sit there. That's it.
Right, yeah. Okay.
We'll appreciate
that's kind of what goes on with some stocks.
That's exactly what does.
Yeah.
Very small stocks very much mm-hmm. often just sit there. Good luck, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Choosing the right investment products, adjusting to life's surprise events, if it's about money and it's important to you, we want to know more about it. We're here for you. 888-99-CHART is how to reach Steve or Justin right now on InvestTalk.
Suraj Fremont. How you doing, Suraj?
Yeah, I'm fine. Steve, thank you. I have a question on the mutual fund.
Sure.
I want to know what the redemption fees are, because I see there's no load mutual funds and there's a redemption fees and it's say 2%. And what that means, they charge you 2% when you sell the mutual fund, or they don't charge if you sell after like certain months, 3 months, 6 months?
What that means, you pretty much kind of know what it is. A redemption fee, even though it's a no-load mutual fund, a redemption fee, it means that if you sell it before a certain length of time, and so, Raj, you have to ask them. It could be 3 months, 6 months, or a year. It could be 9 months. You have to hold it for that length of time, and then there'll be no redemption fee. That's what that means. So the redemption fee is because you're selling it sooner than they want you to sell it.
So if we keep it for that longer term, so there should not be redemption fee, right?
Correct. It goes away.
Okay. All right. That's the only question I have.
Thanks
for
the call.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Suraj. We'll go to George in San Diego. How are you doing, George?
Fine. Thank you, sir. What is your opinion of trust deeds?
Are you a first trustee or a second trustee?
First ones only.
First trustee.
Mm-hmm.
I like them. Okay. George, you mind if I explain it real quick for everybody else what they are?
Yeah, how much risk is there involved?
Okay, and I'll touch on that. A trust deed is where you're talking about a piece of property, everybody, and
right.
you are the bank. You're the bank. Think of you're the one carrying the mortgage. That's what a trust deed is. A trust deed is a mortgage carrier. So let's say someone buys an office building and they need $300,000, and that's a first trustee. In other words, the first trustee means you're the first position. First position means that if something goes wrong, you get paid first.
Right.
Okay? So first trustees I'm very happy with. Second trustees I'm not so happy with. But it also depends on how much equity. In other words, if you loan $300,000 and the building's worth $1 million, and you're the first trustee of $300,000, there's very little risk there.
Exactly.
Because you're going to get your money, even if the guy goes bankrupt on this building, whether it's an office building or a retail shopping center, I don't care, whatever it is.
I still get my money back.
Right. You'll get your money back.
Right.
So the risk, George, goes to how much equity is in there. And if you have 50% coverage, meaning that there's no more than 50% debt as a first trustee, he can have more debt than that, by the way. But as a first trustee, yours, you don't care about those second guys.
You just get paid first.
Yeah, that's right, because you're going to get paid first.
I see.
So as long as you have coverage of 50% or more, that's very low risk, in my opinion. Now, it's not that liquid, meaning you can't just get your money tomorrow. That's not going to happen.
No.
It's a mortgage.
They say they only keep the money for 1 year.
A one-year trustee, is that what they are?
Yeah.
Okay, because they want to get you out of there, probably because they're paying a high interest rate.
High interest rate, right.
There's nothing wrong with them, George. The fear is, let's say they go under.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that happens. You won't get your money immediately. That doesn't happen. They got to then sell the properties. You got to foreclose on them.
Oh, yeah, got to wait, you know, and wait, and wait.
Yeah. But they are very good income producers. So I think that's a good part of your overall investment strategy. I think it's a good idea.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much.
Thanks, George. Appreciate
Bye-bye.
The call. You're listening to InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast continues next. First, a couple of words for KPP Financial. KPP is an independent financial advisor. So what does that mean to you? Well, it means that they don't receive commissions for the sale of investment products, which means they have no conflicts of interest. KPP offers a straightforward approach, personal one-to-one relationships, real-life solutions that just make good sense. When you're ready to find out more about the variety of investing programs from KPP, just go to investtalk.com and click on the Investment tab. KPP Financial. Independent thinking. Shared success. Now let's get back to the podcast. You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Hi, Steve and Justin. This is Jim from Indiana. Listen to this podcast pretty much every day. Quick question about 529 plans. My wife and I were discussing 529 plan. I'm in Indiana. I know the 10% rule, if it doesn't get used for college, that the federal tax will take 10%. But in Indiana, they give us actually a 20% tax credit for whatever we put in. So for every $100 I put in, I'm supposed to get a $20 tax credit. So my question is, I'm trying to parse together my understanding of what the disadvantage of doing this would be at all, because even if my son does not go to college, it seems like I'm still ahead by doing this. Also, was wondering about distributions. My wife had said she knew people in college that didn't get their distributions the way that they had expected, and it was all metered out periodically. So I don't know if you can get that distribution all at once to, say, maybe pay for the whole first year, but there's not enough in the account to pay for all 4 years that you'd get financial aid or whatever. After that, would love to hear your answer. Not sure how that works. Thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you later.
Well, I do know that, you know, you won't get college loans if you need them until you use up the 529 plan. So that money has to be used in most states. And each state has its own rules and regulations. When you set up a 529, everybody, that is a college savings plan for accredited colleges only. And each state sponsors their own 529 program if they want to. And the state can set up the rules within the federal mandate, okay? The state can set up its own rules. And some of those rules are pretty restrictive. Some are not, depending on the state. So you can't make flat statements about all 529 programs other than what I'm giving you. A 529 program has to be, money has to be spent on accredited colleges only. Can't spend it on non-accredited colleges. If you have set up a 529 program for your child and he decides not to go to college, you can transfer the beneficiary to another child. Or you can transfer the beneficiary to your spouse, anybody, a cousin, a niece, a grandchild. Okay, so you could transfer the beneficiary if your children don't go to college. So, and again, you have to go to the state to figure out the rules. For instance, you pointed out your state is giving you a bigger tax credit than a lot of other states don't. So it depends on the 529 program in your state. So you got to look up those rules. And hopefully you could probably maybe talk to an accountant that knows about it and he might be able to help you. Okay? 529. The other thing that you can do for college or higher education is called a Coverdell. A 529 program, you can put up to quite a bit of money, $15,000, $16,000. I don't know what the limit is these days. And a Coverdell, that's per year, by the way, put away. It's not tax deductible, by the way. It's not. And a Coverdell is $2,000. That's not tax deductible either. The difference is a Coverdell, you can use that money for any educational purposes, not just accredited college. And I mentioned truck driving school or beauty school or carpentry school, you know, any of those things. Okay? Thank you for the question. I appreciate that. Did you see that Walmart announced that they partnered with Google for voice shopping? A voice shopping device? Now, what's this about? Well, everybody's heard about Amazon's Alexa, right? You heard it on the TV. This is a response to Amazon. Everybody seems to think Amazon's going to have, you know, the shopping space to itself. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You know, like when Amazon bought Whole Foods, everybody thought, okay, there's a whole food business going to be changed now. No, I'm not convinced yet that, and I've told you before, whether that's going to work for Amazon or not. But Walmart and companies like Walmart, Target, any big retailer, Costco, any big retailer is going to not just sit around and watch Amazon eat into their business. That's not going to happen. So Walmart has partnered with Google for a voice shopping device, just like Amazon's Alexa. Competition, if you ever notice, competition always comes to those who are dominant. Those who are dominant in a space, competition will come. And Amazon's going to be competed with. And same thing is true with Tesla. Tesla dominates the high-end electric cars with their Tesla car. Well, they're not going to be alone for very much longer. And now that Tesla's trying to get into, you know, the everyday car, you don't think Toyota and Ford and those companies, GM, do you think they're just going to sit around and go, oh, well, I guess we can't compete? No, doesn't happen. So I thought this was an interesting development in the shopping wars, I guess we'll call it. And that, just to point out that Amazon is going to be, it's going to have stiff competition because Walmart is big. It has enough horsepower to do that. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Maximizing your credit score. This is InvestTalk Personal. Maximizing your credit score. Achieving the best score you can by following a few simple rules could save you thousands of dollars next time you want to finance a major purchase. Now, here's some example. A 30-year mortgage, $250,000 mortgage. 30-year. $250,000. If your FICO score is 620 to 639, which is not very good, your interest rate today could be about 5.6%. If you scored 760, your interest rate today would be about 4%. These rates, these are, you know, just recent. You know, they're not that old. Your monthly payment would be about $300 cheaper. And the total interest over the life of the loan would be higher. For the, with a higher score, would save you about $80,000. Just because you got a better score. Now, how do they roughly figure out what a FICO score formula is? Where does that come from? Well, 35% of the score comes from history, payment history. Okay, amount that you owed is about 30%. The amounts you owe on your credit. A big part of the category is the ratio of your credit card balances to your credit card limits. Okay, and the ratio of your loan balances to the original principal. They want to see you paying it on, paying it off, paying it down. Length of credit history is about 15%. New credit accounts, about 10%. And this includes, you know, open credit accounts as well as hard inquiries, asking. Just asking for new loans causes your credit score to go down. And also the credit mix. This score comes from the variety of credit accounts you have. For example, if you have a mortgage, auto loan, student loan, and credit card, then that mix could boost your score more than having just one or two of those, assuming you pay them off diligently. So therefore, my score would be lower because I don't borrow money and I don't use, you know, I don't have loans outstanding. So my score is going to be going down. So don't open up unnecessary accounts, okay, and pay diligently on your credit cards and your loans, and your score will go up. That's InvestTalk Personal, everybody. Do you have a question about any of this? Check in now, 888-99-CHART.
You've got a professional advisor at your fingertips for this hour. Why not take advantage? Get your question to Steve right now. He'd love to shed some light on your options and help you learn how to make the best possible money decisions. Join us now at 888-99-CHART or click on Contact Steve anytime on InvestTalk.com.
Okay, let's go to Mike in San Jose. How you doing, Mike?
Steve, I have a question about bonds. I have an Oppenheimer International A-Share Bond Fund, and I put my dividends back in each month. Am I paying that 4.75% each time I put my dividend back in?
Yes, you are. Most of them is the way that happens is yes, you are. Are you buying it direct from Oppenheimer, or are you going through a broker?
When I set it up, it was through a broker.
Check it, but generally speaking, the answer would be yes. He gets a fee every time you buy it. The only reason why I know that is I have a brother-in-law. It wasn't through Oppenheimer, through somebody else, but a big firm like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he did the same thing. He was reinvesting the dividends. You know, it was a very small hit every time he reinvested those dividends. But I said, they should get rid of that completely. And all it took for him was a phone call.
A phone call to who?
To Oppenheimer, through the brokerage firm.
And then the brokerage firm does what?
Waives his fee on the dividend reinvestments. Remember, it's not a lot of money to him. He's not going to make you mad just because, you know, it's just an automatic thing.
I will check.
Yeah, so you got to check that out. I mean, that's something you don't want to just let it go.
Another question about bonds?
Sure.
I get really confused about bonds and how the NAV versus the yield.
It's confusing to a lot of people. Try to remember when you're buying a bond fund as opposed to buying a bond directly, operates a little bit differently. If you bought a bond directly, you could just hold on to that bond, let it mature, and you get your money back plus the interest. But during the time that you're waiting for it to mature, that bond can go up and down in value, right?
Yes.
Bonds go up in value generally when interest rates go down. Now, why is that so? Okay, real simple. If you bought a 10-year bond today paying 5%, tomorrow, if the interest rates go down to 4%, I'm, of course, obviously exaggerating.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, the interest rates for that same bond is now 4%. Isn't your bond worth more at 5% than what you paid for it just the day before? Because now the new ones are 4%. So your bond's paying a whole 1% higher. So the value of your bond actually went up because now bonds are paying less yield. So it's an inverse relationship. When interest rates go down, bond values go up. So in a mutual fund, you first want to know what kind of bonds do they invest in. Do you happen to know, Mike?
Yes, I have a Morningstar software, so I have all 150 bonds that are in it.
Are they junk bonds? Are they government bonds?
All U.S. Treasury note, Japan government, Ireland Republic, Belgium,
okay.
On and on.
International, so they're going everywhere in the world.
Yes.
Then it makes your job a little harder because you have to know what the interest rates are going on in all those different countries. Mike, generally speaking, if the interest rate's going down, Your bond value goes up.
Okay.
If interest rates are going up in general, your NAV, net asset value, will go down. Question.
Thank you, Steve. Bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Good advice. Spread your money around. Stick to a well-thought-out plan for carefully divvying up your money so no single calamity will destroy your portfolio. Want to talk about it? 888-99-CHART is how to get through right now.
I wanted to talk about self-driving vehicles again. I've talked about them often. And I recently purchased a car. And, you know, not a high-end car, but not a low-end car, but, you know, middle to middle-high kind of end car. And I have noticed that this is the beginning of self-driving cars. Because the car, it's an Audi, everybody. An A6. And what it has is, it has the ability to assist me in driving. And what it does is it keeps you from drifting from one lane to another without putting on a signal. It doesn't keep you from it. You still can drift. But as you start the drift over a lane or into a lane, the steering wheel shimmers and shakes, and it tends to push you back where you're in. Also, it automatically brakes. If the car cuts me off and slams on the brakes, the car automatically brakes. So what you're seeing is the beginning of self-driving cars. So what I think we're not that far away. It's probably going to come initially by trucks, interstate truck drivers, interstate truck driving from point A terminal to point B terminal across the state, across the country. I could see that first. Of course, there's going to be rules and laws and regulations that are going to have to be overcome, but I think that's just inevitable. I think self-driving vehicles will be a lot safer than people driving vehicles. You won't have a self-driving vehicle get a DUI, for instance. That'll never happen, right? So it is coming, everybody. I'm kind of looking forward to it. I know a lot of my age group and people are not looking forward to it. They're worried about it. I'm actually thinking, you know what? I think the cars will be safer. And as I get older, my reflexes get slower. I think it'd be a great idea. Because I was just planning on, when I get older and shouldn't be driving, using Uber or the other Lyft. And that's what's going to be my way to get around. Now, I can keep my own car and just tell it where to go. I like it. Embrace the new, everybody. And I want you to know, this is part of creative destruction. A new technology destroying some old technologies. Pretty much like electric cars and gasoline cars. So you just got to, as an investor, you got to figure out where to go, where to invest. How are you going to take advantage of it? How are you going to take advantage of self-driving cars? Well, obviously they're going to be driven by computer chips. We know that, right? There's going to have to be something that drives the vehicle. There's going to be some kind of mechanical devices that turn the steering wheel and puts on signals and do all those things you do when you're driving. So there's going to be some kind of mechanical devices that someone's going to make. Just keep an eye out to see where that's going to come from. I think that would be a good field at some point. You're listening to Invest Talk. Yesterday we talked about parents who were counting on savings and 529 plans to pay for college. Are there other options for parents? How about, do you know what they are? I'm open for any money topic. You can reach me right now at 888-99-CHART. We'll be right back.
to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Hi, this is Dan. I'm a podcast listener in Roanoke, Virginia, and a longtime listener. Just had a question about dividends. The brokerage I use for trading and investing, it does not allow reinvestment of dividends. So I was thinking about trying to invest in dividends using my 401k. There's a dividend fund. It's the BlackRock Equity Dividend Fund. With mutual funds, are dividends reinvested? I just didn't know how that works. Also, I know you've talked before about seeing the fund manager and their track record when you get into a fund. How do you actually find out the track record of the person managing the fund? Thanks a lot. Bye.
Okay, Morningstar.com has all that information on funds, and it will tell you how long the fund manager has managed the fund, and then you look at the performance over the length of time he managed it. That's where you get that information. And reinvesting dividends into mutual fund, you don't have to, or you can. You know, it depends on your brokerage. As you pointed out, the brokerage can make that decision. And you can request it or not request it, but it depends on the brokerage firm to how that works. So if they'll reinvest the dividends into the same fund. And the fund probably has rules on it as well. You just have to ask. You have to ask the question. There's no one answer to that. Appreciate the call, though. Appreciate it. Thank you for the call. Okay, high interest rates are not in our future. Not. Now, high meaning, according to the Federal Reserve President who talked about this, John Williams, means anything above 4%. That's what his definition of high. He also said in the same little speech that we have a new normal GDP growth of 1.5%. Remember, our long-term GDP is over 3%. But he's saying the new normal is going to be 1.5%. And he said the reason he's citing, we have a drop in the working age population. He's talking about more of us baby boomers getting older and dropping out of the workforce. And since we're dropping out of the workforce, we're not adding as much to GDP. We're not adding very much at all. And so he says, because of that, that's going to slow down GDP growth. And that's one of the reasons. And the other reason, he says, we have weak productivity, which I have mentioned on the show numerous times that we do have. We've had weak productivity for some time. Productivity goes directly to, of course, GDP growth, but also your standard of living. The more productive we are, the better our standard of living. Now, I'm going to disagree with him on this, even though maybe he's a lot smarter than I am, but I'm thinking that they're true about the baby boomers, but I don't know about productivity. I think it can rebound fairly quickly. Why do I say that? Well, because corporations have not been reinvesting into their company very much since this last recession. They have not reinvested into new technologies and better and faster equipment and computers and software and systems. They have not reinvested much. And then when they start doing that, that may just pick up productivity and that may just pick up GDP growth. So also, I think the older generation, my generation, they don't have enough money. They got to continue to work. Now, they might not be in the most productive industries because they can't get a job in those, but they're still going to have to continue to work. So I don't think the drag is going to be that much. And I think achieving a 3% GDP growth is well within reason. With the proper rules and regulations coming out of Washington, and part of that is less rules and regulations coming out of there, tax cut, the things they promise could boost GDP up about 3%. Of course, what if they don't achieve what they promise? Which is always true, or going to come true. For instance, they said they were going to have a big tax cut for the middle class. Okay, for us in the middle class, not going to happen. They can't. We have to pay for the tax. We have to pay for everything. It's got to come out of our pocket somehow. Time's up for the hour, everybody. I'm financial advisor Steve Peasley, president of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, and I'm glad you could be with me today. On behalf of Johnson Klein and everybody at the KPP family, I want to thank you for listening, and let's do it again tomorrow. A reminder, personalized retirement portfolio reviews are available without charge no matter where you live in the United States. Just go to InvestTalk.com, click on the InvestTalk tab, and then Portfolio Review.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.